Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. This week, wait a minute. Hold on. My name is Nick.
Litheads, he's breaking down on live podcast TV.
Uh-huh. I have to read the theme that we're doing, because Litheads, I'm discovering it live time when I say it.
This is the extent of Nick's reading prep for the week.
You're listening to it live time. My name is Nick, and this week we're doing a very fun theme. You're going to love it, folks. Fictional autobiographies. What? That's crazy. What is that? I don't know. We're going to find out with these two rascals, these two high school English teachers. Ian and Joe.
Ian, thank you. That's what I was waiting for.
Yeah, I was waiting for the cue.
Nick, I'm not a fake person. I am a real person. I brought an autobiography about a real person, but the autobiography is fictional. It's going to take us a little while to wrap our heads around. And then mine gets more complicated too, because like it's written in the third person, which is like not usually how autobiographies get.
Now there's the third person. Who's in charge here?
But it's like a close third person. Right. And there's internal monologue. Okay, it's called The Noise of Time. It's a Lithead recommendation by returning recommender, I believe, James Oxner. Thank you, James. And it was kind of great. The Noise of Time.
If Joe is a very real person, I want to just let you guys know I am completely generated by AI, which stands for artificial intelligence. As a large language model, I am unable to weigh in on questions of morality and ethics. I'm also an AI high school English teacher. And this week, my name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. Wow, all over the place. This is what AI does. It's unreliable and it's useless, and we should just get rid of it and go back to writing things by hand.
I have a prompt I'd like to share right now.
This week, I brought a book which is not that particularly complex in terms of what it is. It's a fictional autobiography. Mm. It's called The Color Purple. Mm. It was made into a movie, and now it's being made into a musical. It's very much in the public consciousness, and it's a big award winner. Yeah. Take that, America.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Fictional autobiographies, we've done this before.
I think we've accidentally.
Remind me again. This is basically when an author takes a person and their story and fictionalizes it, or it's about them. It's just a fake. It's just fiction, right? I mean, it's.
Yeah, I think there's. I think there's a few different ways you can do it. Like, you could write an autobiography about an entirely fake person. Like, that would be a doable thing. In my case, we have an autobiography that is invented about a very real person, right?
Got it.
Fictional autobiography. In Ian's case, he is talking about a color that is definitely real.
We're not sure I've seen purple. Know. It's in rainbows.
I've seen purple.
Yeah. So we're not sure which part of your book, Ian, is going to be the fiction part, but it's certainly not the color purple.
As far as you know. Maybe it's like a collective, you know,
the idea of a successful
Mandela effect. What if we've all collectively hallucinated the idea of purple?
Right.
Have you ever thought of that?
Is the point of the fictional autobiography, the point is like, is a successful fictional autobiography when you're not sure what is real and what isn't? Is that what makes it successful? Do you know what I mean? Because what's the point? It's just fiction.
Well, Nick, as Dmitri Shostakovich, the protagonist of my novel, would say, the point of art is art, Nick. There's no point to it. It's hard to say what makes these things successful and what things not. And I'm guessing Ian and I, like I think in our books this week, probably do super different things from
they
each
do.
Other and are successful in really different ways.
What subgenre of fictional autobiography you're looking at? Because if you're looking at a fictionalization of a real person, like Wrinkle in Time that Joe brought this week, the goal is to use fiction to instruct about truth, I think. To instruct about, in fact.
I like Joe's answer better. Joe, you're going to end up going first today, okay?
Fantastic.
Finish your thought, Ian. Ian, are you crabby today?
It's fine.
Ian's crabby. He's got family visiting. He's just a little stressed today.
It is a big week for Ian. Ian's traveling this week, recording from sunny California. Well, snowy California.
You're not at your house?
Which you never really think of. No, he's traveling.
Ian, is your family listening to us right now?
No, they rejected the invitation that you issued to sit quietly in the back of the room and applaud when I said stupid things.
I couldn't imagine the torture of this podcast having to only listen to one of us talk for an hour.
It's bad enough. It's bad enough when there are three of us.
Joe, tell me what your book is about.
Dmitri Dmitriev Shostakovich was a real man. He was perhaps Soviet Russia's most famous composer of classical music. Only 10 years old when the February Revolution ended over 400 years of Romanov rule, Shostakovich grew up in a Russia that was changing into a new nation. And it was a nation looking to cement a cultural identity. Enter Shostakovich. He was a musical prodigy. His first symphony, composed as a graduation requirement from a Leningrad conservatory, cemented him as a rising star in Soviet music. And while that moment was a triumph, it forever entangled him with the Soviet state. The two would never break apart. The man was real, but this biography is fake fiction and a lie. This week, I brought Lithead recommendation, The Noise of Time. 2016, 184 pages. Authors out there, we've talked about this before. I don't know if it's a bias that I have because I read a book each week for this show, but if we could get more sub 200 page books, it really makes our lives easier. Yeah. They're amazing. I love them.
I kind of just weed those out when somebody recommends them. I just delete those. See.
What? So there are books sitting in our queue that we are both really excited to read, but they're like 900 pages long, and we're we just can't do this. Like this is challenge. Going to there has to be weeks of planning ahead of time for us to read a 900 page book.
Ian, what's your book about?
This week I brought a fictional autobiography. It's the story of Celie, who is assaulted and impregnated by her stepfather at 14. Of her sister Nettie, a missionary to a remote village in northwestern Africa, a story of their friends, family, and enemies, of forgiveness and confidence and healing and pants. This book won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Wow. It was adapted into a film in 1985, and it's been recently readapted, The Color Purple by Alice Walker.
This is a movie that has escaped me. It came out when I was very, very young. And so
probably maybe too young to see it because it's pretty intense.
It's evaded me. It's all I'm saying. There's no good reason.
I was reading this book around my school this week and multiple people said to me, is this your first time reading it? Kind of in this tone of what's your problem?
Yeah. Don't you teach English here?
how is this your first time reading it? I'm like, it's not British literature, so that's why.
This is a movie that's on my shame list. We've discussed Shameless in the past. It's movies I'm ashamed to admit I've never seen. And it kind of works at the book level.
Yep, absolutely it does, yes. Though I didn't really feel ashamed. It was just this is one that I haven't read before.
You just say, there's a lot of fucking books.
Yeah.
What do you want from me?
I mean, I said it to my students. I say that, I have some sixth graders I say that to.
Hey, back off.
I say it to my son.
To my son.
he's like, Dada, can you read my book?
Right.
And then I just...
And then you read him The Color Purple.
Books.
Okay. Well, these both sound quite interesting. Joe, bringing a lot of Russian media lately. I've noticed that. That's for sure.
Dmitriev Shostakovich. Shostakovich.
Thanks a lot. We're all on a list now. Something about Tucker Carlson. Okay, Joe, tell us what your book is about.
We are. I think it's useful to just note that we are sort of the Tucker Carlson of the podcast. Nice.
Right. I think we're each Tucker Carlson in our own way.
We all wear bow ties unique way. More often. Mm-hmm. Ian, I think, does wear bow ties from time to time, but
you bet I do.
Speaking of straight, white, cis males, I'm going to read you a one-star review to kick us off on this book.
Of my book?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
One star is from Casey the Canadian. less brarian.
That I is think, funnier than anything we are going to say on this show today. That is amazing.
Okay. One word. That was one word. One star. No wonder I haven't read any books by straight white cis dudes in years. This is the kind of mediocre, quote unquote, lit fic shit that gets nominated for the Booker? Two question marks. Ooh, as dry as a piece of toast left out in the sun. If I could have hated this, I probably would have enjoyed reading it more. But alas, it only bored me to tears. Yeah. A few cleverly put phrases. It's hard to read improper sentences.
Sure. Like,
with typos. Okay. A few very cleverly put phrases about art do not an engaging novel make.
So, pretty good.
Great sentence.
Joe, who is the author of this? Because it seems very important to the lesbrarian.
The author of this book is a guy named Julian Barnes, and he's a cis white male. In fact, I'm pretty sure the Booker Prize was only awarded to cis white males for its entire existence until relatively recently.
Booker Prize. I'm going to look this up and share some facts with you guys.
Nick, I've got some Booker Prize facts for you here.
So, did I stumble into a game?
No, not a game. But this is a guy named Julian Barnes.
The next best thing.
Julian Barnes. Julian Barnes is an author. He's been an author since the early 80s, and he's the author that, we talk about kind of like books versus the literature in here. He kind of like rides that line of literature, capital L literature. And the Booker Prize itself has shifted over the years. For a long time, it was for books written in the Commonwealth, right? Like, it is a British award that was given to British authors that were given for something for like the best book written this year. They have some fancy British way of saying that, but like the most cohesive novel composed in the English language, published in the Commonwealth, right?
Feels British.
Right around the time that Julian Barnes won it, Julian Barnes had been shortlisted three times previously. Right around the time he won it, they expanded it to any novel written in the English language that is also published in the Commonwealth, so it could be from anywhere.
And a lot of things are published in the Commonwealth.
And a lot of things are published in the Commonwealth, of course. But from then, for a few years after that, they just kept giving it to English dudes. They're like, it's for anyone. He won it in 2011. It changed a couple of years after that. And then this book, The Noise of Time, is the follow-up book. We've had quite a few Booker Prize winners on this show. Salman Rushdie we've had on this show. George Saunders we've had on this show.
All right. So Casey is pretty spot on so far. So what's the book about, Joe?
So this book is about, as I said, a real person, a composer who I had never heard of, but that only means that I don't have any education in classical music whatsoever. Yeah. It means nothing. Yeah. Yes. I had never heard of this guy, Dmitri Dmitriev Shostakovich. Shostakovich was a real person. Mm-hmm. He was a composer in the Soviet Union, and he was a pretty big deal. Like, when you look at famous Russian composers, like of symphonies and operas and things like that, there's a few names that come to mind, but this is the
guy
that was like...
But let's all name one. I'll go first. Shostakovich. All right, now you guys two more.
Well, as somebody who just read this book, I could also name Tchaikovsky.
Although very good.
He came
Ian.
Quite a bit before this.
Can you name another?
Rachmaninoff. Stravinsky.
I love you.
Stravinsky, there you go.
He's got even more. God, I love him. Mm-hmm. All right, Ian.
Yes.
How had you not heard of Shostakovich?
Oh,
Shostakovich is a deal. Like, he's good. His music is really good.
Yeah, sorry, I grew up listening to farm music, as you guys know.
It's got to have an accordion or a washboard.
Or fiddles or banjos, all would have been appropriate.
A jug. Yes, I think so. Shostakovich had some lost symphonies, which were just accordion and washboard, but they never were produced.
So Shostakovich is a Soviet composer. He's a big deal. And he's a composer who really does, early on in his career, get kind of adopted by the state, right? Like, the Soviet state of Russia listens to the music that Shostakovich is putting out, and they say, yes, this is Soviet music. This is music that celebrates the proletariat, that celebrates the working man. This is music that rejects formality and the bourgeoisie. The characteristics of this music are what we want in Soviet music. Like, this is our cultural musical identity. Shostakovich is ours, right? We love this guy.
I wonder if you can, I'm trying to look up right now, if there's ever been kind of symphony-type music done by a jug band. Because I think that'd be a nice genre to kick off. Okay, keep going, Joe.
So, things are looking pretty good for Dmitri Shostakovich. He's young, he's celebrated, he's a big deal in the Soviet state. But then he composes an opera that Joseph Stalin personally attends, and Joseph Stalin personally does not like.
Fuck that.
He thinks it's a bad opera. And this whole time, this is a scene in the book, and apparently a pretty well-documented scene as well. Stalin is at this opera, which of course means that there's many state people at this opera.
It's a good time.
And they're all watching it, and they're all glancing towards Stalin's box as things happen and kind of giving him these disbelieving looks like, can you believe this? Okay. Do they think this is music? They're reading Stalin's gestures. They're reading Stalin's reaction to it. Yeah. And they're reacting accordingly.
They're reading the room. And just so happens, Stalin is in it.
They're men and yes women.
They're sycophants.
When there's a lot of people in the room, and one of them, Stalin, you pay attention to him the most.
You pay attention
this
to
Stalin. This is why you really don't want your murderous, genocidal tyrants to have any artistic interest.
Right.
Oh, like, exactly.
If they have thoughts about art, you're screwed. As an artist, as a lover of art, like, you better hope that your murderous, genocidal tyrant just likes monster trucks.
You better hope you make good art. Joe, what specifically does he not like about it? Is there some sort of like statement against the country, or is it just bad?
So it's not the theme of the opera that he rejects too, although critics would pick up on the cultural theme and be like, he's celebrating Lady Macbeth. She's a murderer, okay. Et cetera, right? But it is the musical characteristics. Ian hit it right on the head when he said, you don't want your tyrant to like music. Like, you don't want your tyrant to pay attention to you.
That
is an honest to God theme throughout this book, because the second the tyrant pays attention to you, yes, you might have your moment in the sun, but now he's paying attention to you.
He's not a generous lover. You don't want to like get his attention. Lover. Okay, so Joe,
and what he doesn't like about it is it's muddled, right? The next day in the newspaper, these cultural critics start writing these attacks on Shostakovich that say, this isn't music. This is a muddle. This is insane. And there's a line in the newspaper, in the review of his play, or of his in the review of his opera, that says he rejects the proletariat. It is far too formalist, this music.
Wow.
He is being too fancy, too bourgeoisie.
He's being bourgeois. Yep.
Vitally, this might end poorly for Shostakovich, is the line. And the second Dmitri Shostakovich reads that line, he knows that the secret police are coming for him. The second he reads that line, he goes, oh no, the secret police are here. This book opens up, the entire first section of this book is Dmitri Shostakovich. Every single night after his child and his wife go to bed, he gets dressed, he takes a packed bag, and he goes and waits by the elevator at his apartment because he knows that they come for you in the middle of the night. And when they come for him, he wants to go with dignity. And this is, by the way,
And
specifically, he does not want them to go take his wife and child. He wants to be waiting for them by the elevator. He wants to go quietly with them, and he wants this to be over.
Yikes.
Essentially.
Okay.
Ian, you have a question.
Yes. I just want to comment, more of a comment than a question.
Perfect.
Mr.
Holshue, I actually know something about this, and I would like to take a moment to elucidate.
Cultural observation. Okay. You know, we give the Soviet Union a lot of criticism, a lot of crap. But mm-hmm. But I will say this, at least it was a society in which you could offend people by the nature of your music.
It's okay.
The idea of a society that takes that takes art so seriously, that says, you know what? We don't like the, we believe that the musical quality of your composition is politically subversive. Not necessarily the content, but the musical quality is so subversive that we're going to send you to a prison camp. That is a society which is monstrous and horrible, but at least has the right idea about art.
There was so much about this book that blew my mind open because it was so... I have an analogy for you. Have you guys ever gone to a board game night at a friend's house and you're introduced to a complex board game for the very first time that maybe other people know?
Ooh, Architects of the Western Kingdom?
Or I mean, anything. There's a billion board games.
I'm going to stick with that.
Twilight Imperium, then.
When that happens to me, and that happens to me from time to time, the first hour of that night, I live in dread because I do not understand the rules of what is going on. There is something in front of me that is complex. There is something in front of me that other people seem to see the inner workings of, and something in front of me that I, at the time, feel I do not have access to.
You're a dum-dum.
Yeah.
I feel like a dum-dum.
Yeah.
That's how I felt at the beginning of this book. The entire first, probably 30 pages of this book.
Who this composer was.
I didn't know who this guy was. I didn't know what the rules of this society were. Like, this guy is composing in a nation in which people care enough about art. Like, a nation that takes its cultural identity seriously, and a nation that makes, that takes autocratic, sometimes tyrannical, like, steps to preserve, advance that cultural identity, whether it's through music or art or literature or chess or whatever it is. They see that these cultural creations of their citizens as reflecting directly back on the nation, and they want to have some control in that. That blew my mind, that idea. It's so different from how culture works, I think, in America, for example.
I think that the issue comes when there is a man with a big mustache at the top saying, not only do we take our art seriously, but also here is the art that does match who we want to be, and here's the art that doesn't match who we want to be. And oftentimes the stuff that matches who we want to be is just directly self-serving to that man with the big mustache.
Yeah, and by the way, if you compose outside of that genre, like outside of these very narrow parameters, welcome to Siberia, welcome to a work camp, I hope you like digging canals.
Do they have a lot of canals in Siberia?
Yeah, for the ice to flow through. contrasting this to like a more democratic, a more sort of open source approach like we have in the US, where, you know, if you're three white guys, you want to talk about books, you can do it. And there's going to be nobody from the state saying this doesn't match what we think America should be. It like that allows freedom, that allows diversity. But along the way, if everyone has a microphone, then nobody's microphone matters, including ours.
How does this book fall into fictional autobiographies? This is a real person. This all happened until what's the turning point here?
Yep. This is a real person whose life almost existed entirely within Soviet, like dictatorship Russia. Right? Like, for the majority of his life, Joseph Stalin was in charge of Russia. Once Joseph Stalin dies, of course, Khrushchev becomes, Joseph Stalin does die eventually, spoilers. Khrushchev becomes in charge, and then it's just kind of a different flavor of the same stuff. The reason that this becomes a fictional autobiography, well, number one, Shostakovich himself did not write it, so it is not an autobiography. Mm-hmm. Like, let's start
That's going to be critical.
Mm-hmm. Number two, it's incredibly internal. Like Shostakovich, it's written in third person, but he's absolutely our point of view character. Hmm. So we get his thoughts, his feelings, his reactions, his musings, at times a stream of consciousness of what he's thinking, his own reflections on art, his own reflections on dictatorships, on communism, etc. Right? And number three, he lived to be a relatively old man, or at least have a relatively illustrious career inside of this, inside of these strictures. The information that was let out of Russia, of Soviet, the Soviet Union at the time, was heavily modified by the state. Like, there are tons of things that were published that were written, I'm putting big quotes around written.
I see them.
By Shostakovich. Articles, pieces of criticism, right, reviews that were written in quotes by Shostakovich that he had no part in whatsoever. Somebody would knock on his door in the middle of the night. They would hand him a piece of paper. They would say, we plan on publishing this tomorrow. You wrote it, by the way. And he would sign it and it would get published. So one of the things that makes this a fictional biography is in order to write this, both biographers and then the novelist Julian Barnes had to sift through so much Shostakovich stuff and decide to what degree is this real? To what degree does this reflect Shostakovich the man, Shostakovich the composer, and Shostakovich like the cultural icon that the Soviet state used? And it's been a problem for biographers for as long as people have been writing biographies about this guy, who people super care about, because his life is in so many ways constructed by the Soviet state. The story of his life is constructed by them.
So they never kill him. They never take him off.
Oh, but Jesus, he wishes they would.
They decide, so they turn him into a puppet of the state. They're like, why would we send this guy to Siberia when we can make him, when he can help us control people?
100%.
Yeah.
It's 1984. It's 1984. He loved Big Brother.
He loved Big Brother.
So how much of this... Okay, so this is my big... Obviously, the biggest gripe with fictional autobiographies is what the fuck actually happened?
Yep.
Is what happened...
We've been here before.
And yeah, this is a dead, dead conversation that we've beaten several times. Because there is it basically all internal monologue is obviously, you know, made up? It seems like it's very pretty clear, though, in this book. Like, the internal monologue stuff has to be... the authors, you know, what they've pieced together. And then I would imagine the things that are actually happening are all pretty well documented.
Yeah. So, well, again,
the concerts,
who's
and,
to say, right? Like these concerts seem like they've definitely existed. But the author, I actually almost didn't read the author's note. And in You Don't Know Lit Tradition, I finished this book this morning as I was making coffee. Yeah, thank you. And I almost didn't read the author's note because it was like two extra pages at the end. And I happened to glance at it right before I came down. And Julian Barnes speaks specifically to this, like specifically to the challenges of figuring out what's real. And basically what he says is, hey, there's a lot of sources that I drew from, right? Like you might recognize things from this pretty famous biography that was written about him by this other person. There was also a series of memoirs that were published from him in like the 80s or something like that. 1979, the memoirs of Shostakovich as related to this other writer that were published. That series of memoirs, it set off its own Shostakovich wars, they were called, as people tried to figure out what was real and what was not in them. But he said, basically, I've pieced things together. I've worked with biographers. I've worked with Shostakovich scholars to try to figure out what do we think is real at this point. And I have tried to present this as cleanly as I could. And he says, all of this, of course, is highly frustrating to any biographer, right? But most welcome to a novelist.
Right? Sure. It seems to me, Nick, you say this is a dead conversation, but this is one where... not only is the factual historical record cloudy because of what the Soviet Union did to sort of historical records, but also the internal life of this man is cloudy. Mm-hmm. What better place, what better sort of opportunity for a novelist to use fiction to express truth? Like, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm dismissing your question, Nick. It doesn't really matter whether it's true or not, like factually, because guess what? He probably didn't even know how he felt himself.
Yeah.
People are not so simple. Most people are not so simple as to say, here is my 8-pointed personality star that this fully expresses who I am statically, not changing over time. People vary. People change. External inputs affect how we are in the world. So this seems like a perfect medium for this kind of story. A man whose historical life is somewhat shrouded, a man whose psychology is definitely shrouded, a man who may not have known himself particularly well, as do any of us. Why not write a novel about that?
Once I got into this book a little bit, and once I started to understand the rules of what we were talking about, the rules of the game that we were all playing here, I got really into it. Like, I thought it was fascinating. I loved the fine line that Shostakovich had to walk his entire life between making this art, but making art that wouldn't offend, but making art that was still truthful and not shrouded in like cynicism or
you enjoyed his misery.
Well, I enjoyed his navigation of his misery. I thought it was really interesting.
Dance for me, puppet, dance.
Before I wrap up, I do want to get to why James Oxner recommended this book.
What did he write? Thing.
He said, it seems that people increasingly use the terms tyrant or tyrannical dictator to describe some contemporary lackluster politicians. This book by Julian Barnes defines the above-mentioned leadership styles in a crystal-clear narrative that should serve to educate the reader and shame those who use these terms loosely. I mean, first of all, I love what James is saying here. I totally agree, but it also blew my mind because I read this after I had finished the book, or like when I was playing a couple pages away from finishing the book. This morning, I'm like, oh, I want to see why James like recommended this book. Like, why did this come about outside of the theme? And it blew my mind because like what James got from this book, like why James loved this book, was not what I got at all. He's right. It's in there. It is absolutely a portrait of somebody living under a tyrannical dictator, right? And like, and it is very different from living under, you know, the political party that you don't like. But I thought like the study of the man was so interesting. I thought the stuff about music was so interesting. Just the idea that as Ian said earlier, that like an opera could have proletariat or bourgeoisie characteristics. It blew my mind. Right? I was like, what do you mean? It was good. I really dug it.
Well, that's kind of like when Elvis came out, right? This was like just the sound of Elvis was so new and so it got people going. Like you could see how music affects people with or without words.
Well, I started thinking about like, do we have patriotic music? Right? That was like one of my first thoughts. And of course, we could talk about national anthems and stuff like that. Freebird. Yeah. The first thing that came to mind is, I think it's a Toby Keith song, Toby Keith,
love
right?
That guy.
Where it's like the one of like, we'll put a boot up your ass. It's the American way. Like the country song that came out after 9/11.
Oh, sure.
It's like,
Oh yeah. It's
like this hyper patriotic to the point now when you listen to it, it's a song that makes me a little uncomfortable to listen to now because it is so red, white, and awesome. We're going to drop bombs on you. Like this really, like a declaration of war, right? Like a celebration of war.
Yeah. Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, The Angry American by Toby Keith.
And
people loved it.
And people,
Toby Keith, RIP.
When I introduced 9/11 to groups of juniors right now, and it's an event they're always familiar with, I very frequently show them this song and I explain the mood of hyper-patriotism in the U.S. after the 9/11 attacks and how this song was played totally unironically on the radio. Like this song was a huge freaking deal on the radio, which now with, you know, 22 years of retrospect, you look at and think like, wow, that was art that came out of a pretty troubled nation, right? That was art that came out of a nation that was looking for a cultural identity and found it in, we're going to kick your ass. And it's a line that comes up again in this book. But in this book, he says like the first time it happens, it's history. The second time it happens, it's farce, right? Like when we look back 20 years later, it seems farcical. And the third time it happens, it's tragedy, right? So like we see, like when we look at Toby Keith now, that song seems a little farcical, right? When we see that history repeating itself, it feels tragic, right? Because we see the farce of what it was 20 years ago. It was a super good book. I loved the recommendation. It was a complex board game that I learned to play throughout reading it, if that analogy holds up at all. It was awesome. Thanks a lot, James.
Ian, what's your book about? The Color Purple. I've never seen the full movie, the original or the remake. I know nothing about it.
Okay.
It's supposed to be great.
I associate it with Oprah and Whoopi Goldberg. How am I How am I doing?
And the color purple.
No, neither.
Oprah and Whoopi Goldberg starred in the 1985
mm-hmm. Oscar winning,
which makes a lot of sense.
Didn't win any Oscars. Nominated for 11.
Wait a minute.
Didn't win any of them.
Didn't Whoopi Goldberg win? Oh wait, I was just reading about this. This is like a famous snub.
Yep. A lot of people thought it was the best movie of the year, Roger Ebert among them, but it did not win a single Oscar. Danny Glover is also in it.
Whoopi Goldberg would, of course, win her Oscar for Sister Act.
Sister Act.
No, that can't be true. I have no idea what she won it for. She does have an EGOT, though. She has won them all.
She's one of my husband's big ones. Yeah, she won Ghost.
Welcome to the live Googling section of a podcast.
Sorry. No, I just wanted to finish. Yeah, the point was that they were like they were nominated for like absolutely everything, and they should have won absolutely everything, and they won absolutely nothing. Yeah,
you imagine just a long history like you're gonna
white cis male awards here. welcome to our white cis male award episode. Ian, what is the book about?
So the book is a fictional autobiography. It's written as a series of letters,
epistolary.
Oh, whoa!
Yeah, good job. It's epistolary. Look at you. Kind of applauding himself. Look at that.
We're here to learn.
He's got it. This is an epistolary novel. It's written mostly, I would say, two-thirds of these letters are from a woman named Seeley, and the other third fractions are from her sister, Nettie. So Seeley has a hard life. She is assaulted. She's actually assaulted by her stepfather when she is 14. That's like how the novel begins. Okay. It's like, here we go. Gives you a real sense of where we're going. And Seeley and Nettie are separated quite young. Seeley has to go off and get married to a man who abuses her. And Nettie's gone.
What is the setting of this
Seeley
book?
Loses track of her. This is set in Georgia in the early 1900s. So it starts kind of around the turn of the century, and we're getting towards the end as World War II is underway.
Okay.
So it's like slavery is in the past, but racism and oppression are very much not in the past. And so,
what is the year here?
It's an autobiography. It's her life. So it runs from like maybe 1905 ish all the way through the 1940s.
Oh, okay.
It ends sometime in the 1940s.
Got it.
So. And she Walker writes this in the 1980s, so it's coming out a generation after the Great War, or sorry, not the Great War, World War II. The Great War is a different war.
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah, so
the Greater War.
It was a pretty.
So this
good
is
war.
A book which kind of starts off really, really, really grim, and there's a lot of trauma just in general. People behaving badly to each other. There's not just like the sexual assault and the domestic violence. There's betrayal. There's some racial injustice, just kind of like as a running thing.
Right, like sprinkled racial injustice.
Right. It's sort of a fact of life, and Walker doesn't downplay it, but her focus is I would say not primarily on the racial injustice as much as it is on sort of human drama, heartbreak and healing. So this is a really hopeful book. I finished it yesterday and I was crying. The way it ends, like, it's not long, it's 250 pages, but we go from a place where our main character Seeley, like, she believes she has no worth, absolutely none. Nobody loves her. She believes nobody can love her. She believes she won't be happy. She has really no hope whatsoever. And by the end, she is in a really, really beautiful place. She's in a, not heaven. She didn't die. It's not like, it's not like a cop-out. She heals over the course of the novel. I'm trying to avoid spoilers because, you know, there are some big good things that happen to her, but, it's a novel which starts you off and makes you think this is going to be really grim. You're going to end up feeling kind of angry and fired up, and you remain angry throughout it, but by the end it's joyful. It's really joyful.
Fictional autobiography. Was this based on a real person? Journals?
I'm smirking because no, this is a fictional imaginary
totally person. No source material here except history.
No. except the way things were. But let me read you two pieces of this. The very first words of the book and the very last words of the book. So her dedication, Walker's dedication, is to the spirit, without whose assistance neither this book nor I would have been written.
To the spirit.
So you read that and you're like, interesting, opaque. The idea of a person being written is interesting, I guess.
It's a ghost book.
And then
book.
The last.
It's a ghost story.
Yeah, ghost book. Maybe. And she capitalizes spirit. It's like, and you kind of notice
the honorific.
It. The last line of the book. I thank everybody in this book for coming. A.W., author and medium.
Wow. So she's like literally saying like, I spoke to the Holy Spirit. Like this was delivered to me from, maybe not the Holy Spirit, but like.
Not the Holy Spirit. I read this as like, she is doing that author thing where she says, I'm not creating these characters. I am, I'm a medium. I am speaking. These characters are speaking through me. When you talk to authors about, especially like the way they write characters, but sometimes plot, they talk about, Stephen King talks about this, is you're not creating, but you're discovering. You like say, here's this person. How would they interact? What would their life be like? And I read this as Walker kind of making a claim about history and truth that, yeah, she's the author. She calls herself author and medium, but she's saying there is truth here. There is reality, even though like we don't have the reams and reams of notes from this woman. She doesn't ever get a last name in the book. She's just Celie. Her sister is just Nettie. Nettie does get a last name when she gets married, but like Celie is just her. She is.
That's part of the world building, right?
She is any black woman of this era.
Yeah.
She is all black women of this era, but she's not really. And Walker says, I am channeling her. And I was preparing for this. I was trying to put together my 30-second plot section. I wanted to be specific about the area of Africa that Nettie, the sister, is a missionary to. And so I was Googling around and I couldn't find anything. And so I was Googling the name of the tribe that she's a missionary to. And there are a lot of other people who've had the same question as me. It's a book which sort of invites you to ask like, well, how true is this? Yeah. And I think whereas Joe's book this week suggests like it's all true. It might not be all factual, but it's all true.
Yep.
My book says, no, this is fiction, but it's fiction in order to, it's not, none of it is factual. Mm-hmm. The Olinka, the tribe that Nettie goes to, they don't exist.
Oh,
they're
really?
Fictional. But the novel says we will use obviously not factual material to say something true.
Yeah.
Well, because we don't want that to be the conversation, I think, is part of it too, right? Like if some felt real and some felt not, it would be, you end up with this kind of muddled mess, but it's like, well, look, we're going to use this tribe that is a stand-in for this sort of thing that you understand, right? Like you don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Fiction has always fiction has the ability to be larger than fact. Always.
Right.
Because it uses your imagination and you have to learn about other things. Tell us about Alice Walker. I don't really know anything about her.
She was the first black woman to win the Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
So that's nice for her. She participated in the civil rights movement. This is her. This is the big book for her. She's been a poet. She's a poet and a short story writer. People know Alice Walker for The Color Purple. This is the one. This is kind of her, and she's continued working after this, but
it looks like this is the subject that she stays in though.
Yeah. So, and she's an activist and I kind of feel like maybe we've talked about,
this is her free bird is what you're saying.
Yeah. This is like, so Richard Wright, the native son, situation, where, you know, you write one or two books and those are early on and those are super, super popular and they sell a bunch. And from that, you get the comfort to kind of do what you want with the rest of your career. And maybe that's like you keep writing really banger books. Maybe you write, you know, a book every 5 years and you spend a lot of time doing speaking engagements, doing book signings, doing activism, consulting on various projects. And I get the sense that Walker, Her success with The Color Purple allowed her to kind of do things that she felt really passionate about.
Yeah.
Not that she's not passionate about writing. I don't know her, but her work is wide ranging.
Right. It opened the door to so much more. It's like, look, I could keep writing novels.
She doesn't have to just keep writing novels to make her money.
Think about your jobs. Yep. If you all of a sudden made just a bunch of money, it's like, well, what do I want to do?
Yeah.
You know, am I here to write books or am I here to like share a message?
Well, and I think the other thing that happens too is you write The Color Purple, it turns into like this big Oscar buzz movie. It's like a cultural phenomenon. And I think there has to be this sense of like, well, I'm not going to do that again. Right? Like, I can't write another Color Purple. So I'm not even going to try, or maybe not try, but like, that's not my goal. That cannot be my goal because it is unattainable. Right? How else can I make an impact?
What's the general premise? I mean, it's in the South.
So she starts off assaulted and impregnated by her stepfather. She bears two kids from that.
It's not good.
It's really kind of a dark way to begin. And then those kids are taken away from her. Her sister also, she's concerned that her sister will also be assaulted. So she sends her sister away. And then a bunch of the book kind of revolves around her marriage to Mr. Blank. He doesn't have a last name. She doesn't like say his last name in the book. It's a blank line. I'm just now, like, as we talk about it, realizing that this is the way that she's denying like his hold on her. She doesn't take his last name because we don't learn his last name. She's just always Seeley. Mr. Blank is really, really dreadful to her. He's got some kids already. She kind of like tends to the kids as they grow up. There is a huge sprawling cast of characters. Mr. Blank is in love with a singer named Suge, and eventually Seeley falls in love with Suge. So there's this huge kind of sprawling people, like, kind of, you know, they pop up, they're important to the plot. Some things happen with them and then they drop out gradually over time. Seeley learns to accept that she has value. Everyone says early on, you're ugly, you're hideous, why would anyone like you? You're broken, you're damaged goods, you're worthless, you can't cook, you can't clean, like, you have no value. Mr. Blank does this, a bunch of other people do this. So she internalizes this. Over the course of the book, she gradually starts to kind of come out of that. And by the end of the book, she is in a really, really like healthy, much more healthy place. She's making pants.
What gets her out of that?
Pants.
I'm sorry?
Pants.
What gets her out of
pants? Pants get her out.
Pants
of
get her out of
pants.
It. Is this a music thing too? Is this Secret Music Books?
Not really. No, so her husband, Mr. Blank, is in love with this singer. The singer's named Suge Avery. And Seeley falls in love with Suge too. And eventually Suge is like, you know what, Mr. Blank, I'm done with you. Me and Seeley were gonna go off. And so that's a relationship which is really important to Seeley. Also, Seeley starts getting letters from her sister. So I said this is written in epistolary format. These letters begin as letters to God. Then, eventually, when she starts getting letters from Nettie, Seeley starts writing back to Nettie. And eventually, we start getting to read Nettie's letters to Seeley. So we are learning about Nettie's life over in Africa as well. So we kind of have these two parallel threads running where Nettie is struggling with, you know, what does it mean to be a black, an American black missionary in Africa? What does it mean to be a Christian missionary in Africa? What does it mean to be a black Christian when Christianity has been kind of, and they talk about this, has been kind of like the white people's religion? So there are a lot of different kind of swirling factors, and Seeley and Nettie are apart for a lot of the book, but eventually they reconnect in part due to their letters.
There's a lot of one-star reviews. Not a lot of one-star reviews. There's 8,000 out of 400,000.
It's a controversial book, for sure.
A lot of people start off with, every single one starts off with an apology. This person says, I'll be the a-hole.
I swear I'm not racist, but...
This person says, it's not easy to give a negative review. This one writes a letter to God saying, dear God, I'm sorry, I can't.
Oh, boy. That's so cringe. Oh, my
but,
goodness.
A lot of them just saying, like, couldn't get through this, couldn't get through the style, wasn't as impactful as their... A lot of them talk about their expectations for this enormous classic. Like, it is an iconic book. And a huge classic book, and maybe it misses the mark in terms of their imagination versus what it delivers. Mm-hmm. Like, why is this book so famous? Why is this book so lauded?
Well, I see. So I think part of there are two answers here. And I don't know what all the critics, would say, but I would say from my perspective, there are
fuck
two
the
parts.
Haters. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
First, yeah. First is the form. So I've mentioned the epistolary piece, and it's not just like, I'm writing a bunch of like dear diary. She starts off writing to God, and she does this because the first, like before we get to her first letter, we have a quote from her stepfather who says, you better tell nobody about this but God, because he's the only one who would believe you.
Yeah.
So then she starts writing letters about her trauma to God.
You're saying that's why this is a famous iconic book, is just the style in which is written is very
in part the style. So there's the epistolary thing, but then we gradually add more voices, more letter voices, and oftentimes this is one thing I kind of got towards the end. Oftentimes epistolary novels have a very clear chronology. I write you a letter, you write me a letter, back and forth.
Pen pals.
But these are letters going back and forth across the Atlantic, right? And so she is sending letters, not knowing if she'll ever get letters back. But the chronology here makes you think about distance, it makes you think about disconnection, and it makes you think about form in a way that's not obtrusive, but it's really, really fun and meaningful. I don't quite know what it means, but it's meaningful. That's the first reason. The second reason is the secret learning. So Walker has a lot of big thoughts about a lot of big things: ecology, Native American rights, racial issues, gender, sexuality, religion, philosophy, the world.
There's a lot packed in here.
There's a lot going on in 250 pages.
Yeah. There's music and dance.
Yeah, right. There's culture, there's human relationships. And I think she's focused on this. Celie is not powerful. Celie is not a big deal. Celie is just a woman. She's just a one woman from rural Georgia who makes it big because of pants. But for the most part, she's just a kind of an every woman. Pants. She makes it big because of pants.
Keep saying that. I don't really understand it.
Well, you should maybe ask a question about it, because I'm kind of trying to invite you to ask a question.
It's been hinted
at
several times. Hey, Ian, I have a question.
I come up with my own questions. Yeah, hey, Joe. Thank you.
What's with the pants? I couldn't help but notice that you lightly alluded to pants at like three or four different instances in this
or
conversation.
Or 8 or 20.
Yeah, yep.
And,
what's up with pants?
He's not wearing any.
Oh, I'm not. No, that's all. That's all there is to say. No, a big part of her healing process is learning to make pants for people. She hand sews pants for her family. And she matches the style and the cut of the pants to the person. So like, okay, you work in the fields a lot. You want to have something that will withstand that, but you also like to look good. So I'll make a pant that's flattering for you. Mm-hmm. And this is a way that she kind of regains her value for herself. She shows her love for people. She can pay attention to people, their needs. And it feels a little bit out of left field, because all of a sudden she's having like a personal healing because of her seamstress work, mm-hmm. because of the pants. But by the end of the book, like, Celie's pants are super, super important. Celie's pants are one of the ways, like, when she sends you a pair of pants, you know she loves you.
Yeah.
She's selling pants. She's kind of a pants mogul. It's pretty great. It's unexpected, but it's pretty great.
Gentlemen, welcome to Tiffany's, a safe place for you to tell me the things you hated about your book. Joe, go first.
If I hated something about this book, I would say I had that board game feeling, that queasy board game feeling, the entire first section of this book. Like, you are launched into a stream of consciousness from this guy that, once again, I had never heard of before. I had a hard time. I had to read a lot of, like, the context of his life. Like, ooh. 20 pages into this book, I was reading his Wikipedia page because I'm like, okay, who, what on earth is happening?
That's
here?
Good advice. Skim the wiki before you jump in. Ian, well, that's enough. Yeah. Ian? Jesus Christ. Ian?
I don't really have... I guess what I hated about this book was how surprised people were when I told them I'd never read it before.
I'm not a racist, that really, but I've never read The Color Purple before.
I said it didn't bother me, but it did bother me.
That hey, what?
I don't have time to read everything.
That you didn't read it?
I'm working my way through these cultural importantly things. So, right. You know, cut me some slack, everyone at my school.
And by the way, I've read a lot of stuff that you haven't, dummy. Yeah. So, it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, these both sound really good. Good book bringing, guys.
Well, thank you, James.
You did it.
They both sound good. Joe, you lose probably for no reason except... Yeah. I don't know. I just don't like the way your face looks today.
Well, we do have a history of Lithead recommendations losing on this
right.
show. It's not 100%, but it's pretty common. Thank you again, James Oxner.
This is a book that I would be interested in reading.
I'm super happy I read it.
On my own time.
Yeah. Litheads, you know what to do. Head on over to tweenvogue.com, suggest a book if you too want to see it go down in flames and us lose it on your behalf. Suggest a theme, request a sticky. You can find us at youdontknowthatpodcast.com once the cease and desist order comes from Teen Vogue. Until then, tweenvogue.com. You can follow us on social media, although the only place we really are ever going to post anything ever again is TikTok, because that's where the engagement is, according to Nick. And I feel like I'm missing something. Congratulations, Ian. Congratulations, Litheads.
Bookish friends.
Yeah, of course. As always, you could tell a bookish friend. And once again, thanks to James Oxner.
I don't like that I'm never congratulated.
Well, you are the Stalin of this podcast. This is just a cult of personality.
Stalin got a lot of compliments for sure. You don't have to mean it, Joe. You don't have to mean it. I would like
congratulations, Ian. You absolute book licker.
I'm going to read. Hey, you know what? You guys did a really good job of getting through this whole up my whole time. Maybe because you weren't listening. Getting through my whole time without asking about the title, The Color Purple.
I
assumed it was a spoiler.
It's not. No, it's actually a big theme of the book. So I'm going to explain this theme as part of my quote here at the end. This is a book about healing. It's a book about finding beauty. And the color purple crops up at key moments in this book when people are sort of taking a moment to revel in beauty. So the quote I'm going to read is a point when Celie, our main character, is talking to her lover, friend, sister, kind of sister in arms, Shug, about God. And the two of them are going back and forth on, like, what does it mean to be religious and what does it mean to kind of find peace in religion? And they're talking about, like, well, the God that we were always taught about was kind of a white man's God. He looks like white people. And they're talking about, like, well, what does it mean? What does God mean if you're not white? What does that look like? So Shug says, listen, God loves everything you love and a mess of stuff you don't. But more than anything else, God loves admiration. Celie says, are you saying God's vain? No, says Shug. Not vain, just wanting to share a good thing. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it.